Gascoigne going to have a crack? He is, you know. Oh, I say! Brilliant!
Oh, this young man is a sensation! Dele Alli, out of League One, into the Premier League! Oh, what a goal! It's Danny Rose on his Premier League debut!
Sheringham flick, and Klinsmann is in!
He's got it lost under his feet, and it's come from the middle!
Welcome back to another edition of the Internet's most dangerous Tottenham Hotspur podcast. It's Wheeler Dealer Radio. I'm your host, Greg, and I'm joined by two of our lovely and always supportive co-hosts today. It is Ben Daniels and Brian Ashlock here to talk about just a fantastic, outstanding game against Newcastle United. Ben, do you have something you want to share with the group?
Woo, two wins in a row. We're back, baby.
Brian, how are you feeling about our stunning victory against Newcastle United?
I feel some way about it, I'm sure. We'll figure it out as we go.
Yeah, let's figure it. I feel like it was kind of a weird game to talk about, because Tottenham, especially after such a good performance against Arsenal, I thought it was a bit of an underwhelming performance from Tottenham. But at the same time, we are getting what we were kind of hoping for, after the quarantine break, which was Harry Kane seems to be playing halfway decent in more than one game at a time. So, is it okay? Is it? I think we were pretty down on Kane coming off his injury let off. But Ben, is it delusional to start sort of dreaming on Kane resembling something like his former self?
You know, I mean, I think we talked about this after the Arsenal match, and the Arsenal match and the West Ham match of the games we've played so far since Project Restart, I guess, as we're calling it.
Jesus Christ.
You know, we're the only two clear, solid, you know, Harry Kane is back type Harry Kane performances. And there was a lot of games in between those matches where he did not look like himself. But suddenly we have Harry Kane playing well two games in a row in a three-day short turnaround, and I don't know. Like, that's a step. That's a new thing that we haven't seen from Kane before.
Well, in a while.
Well, in a long while. You know, I think we have kind of resigned ourselves to, okay, Harry Kane is back, but you know, he's probably, like, maybe 90 minutes a week at best back. Like, he's got to manage his minutes. He can't play twice in a row. You know, let's give him time off against the easy teams and save him for the games that matter. Or, you know, just managing his minutes seemed to be an important part of the Harry Kane conversation. And now suddenly, you know, two games on the bounce, 3 days in between them, Harry Kane has put up two of his best performances of the season. I don't know what to make of that because I am incapable of optimism. But if I were someone else, I would say this is a really good sign about the future fitness and productivity of Harry Kane.
Brian, I think one of the things we've talked about with Kane, in the past is that, you know, we feel like when a lot of Spurs fans have said, oh, well, you know, his supporting cast isn't as good, and, you know, that's the reason he's been bad. And I think we've been at least semi-dismissive of this on this podcast, because I think, there's the valid point of when Harry Kane was one of the best in the world, he was creating his own shots. He was, you know, if he was as good as he was in, you know, 2016, it wouldn't matter who's in midfield, or it wouldn't matter a whole lot who's in midfield. I don't know. Like,
he was great with Ryan Mason and Nabil Bentaleb.
Yeah, but at the same time, like, it's hard for me not to look at that, like, Bergvine assist and not think, boy, if there's a more, and maybe it's partly because he's diminished, but boy, if there's a more cohesive structure around him that is functional, maybe, you know, we're going to start to see better things out of him. I don't know. It really occurred to me that was a great pass that Bergvine sort of dropped on his head for that goal, and I just couldn't help think if we could somehow build a functional midfield again, on this team, which you know, with some of the pieces that we have and some of the pieces that we're talking about adding this summer, isn't maybe the most far-fetched thing in the world. I mean, do you think the supporting cast has anything to do with his performances, or it's just him getting back up to speed, you know, in his Harry Kane way?
I think in these matches, I think it's been a lot about building fitness, and I think it's been a lot about knocking off a lot of rust. Because, I mean, we have to remember that he spent quite a long time on the sidelines before Project Restart. So
how are we the only fucking people calling it Project Restart?
Definitely not the only people saying it.
Some Spurs fan in the Premier League communications office who happens to listen to us, and he's thinking, finally, somebody.
My name is catching on. They've got it down. I think most of kind of what we have seen in the last 5-6 games is attributable to him just getting kind of back up to game speed. It's always taken him a while to get back to that level when he comes back from injuries. I mean, we saw it when he came back from the last ankle injury that he had. It took him, you know, 5-7 games to get kind of up to speed. So this time he got up to speed a little quicker, but perhaps that's aided by the longer layoff where he was actually off and recovering, unlike he had in the past. I do think there is some merit to the statement that maybe we need to build a functional team around him, because I think the ultimate thing with Harry Kane is he is a striker. He is a player that wants to do everything. He wants to drop deep and pick up the ball. He wants to find himself in running the channels. He wants to, you know, link midfield and attack. He also wants to score goals. And so as he gets older, and not to say that he is necessarily less physically capable now, but as injuries have started to take their toll and he's perhaps lost like a little bit of pace and maybe a little bit of mobility. I know we're talking about him like he's some decrepit old man, but like, you want him to focus on the things that he's good at. And for Harry Kane, that is getting shots in the box. And so, yeah, does it make sense to have a functional, you know, number 10 or, you know, a midfielder who links the attacking line and the midfield? Does it make sense to have, you know, good fullbacks that can bring width to play and you know, play good cutbacks and good crosses? Does it make sense to have players like Steven Bergwijn who can either dribble and create their shots or make amazing crosses like the one he did today? Yeah, absolutely it does. If you can minimize all the other stuff that Harry Kane has to do, then to me, you can maximize his Harry Kane just scoring goals. So yeah, obviously it makes sense to get a team that is coherent around Harry Kane.
But I guess the flip side of that argument is, like, some of what we're seeing out of Kane is the fitness stuff. Like, that third goal in this match was, I mean, vintage Kane in a lot of ways. Amazing pass sort of at midfield. Hauls his ass down the pitch, crashes the box, and is there to clean up a sort of spilled shot. And fitness, I guess, is the explanation for this, but we've complained a lot on this podcast about how we haven't seen Kane doing that. I mean, I'll be very happy if it's just rust and he needed to knock it off, because it seems like he's doing, and I don't have a great explanation for it beyond it's just getting back sort of up to snuff from a long layoff, because he's just doing things that some of it is fitness related, but some of it just doesn't, it just appears to be a decision he's making. And I don't quite understand why he's suddenly doing these things that he wasn't doing earlier.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's definitely something that's happening with Harry Kane that is different. And it's not just the players around him. You know, we've seen him now have 3 games where he put up a lot of shots. West Ham, Arsenal, and now Newcastle. Against Arsenal, he had 9 passes. You know, he was playing a very, very simplified, reduced role of guy in the box who waits for his forward line to get him the ball, and he shoots in good positions. And, you know, credit to the rest of the team. I thought we did a phenomenal job against Arsenal. Everybody was kind of on song, and were able to get him the ball where they needed to. This match, he had 17 passes, which, you know, it's not a ton of passes, but it is the most he's managed since Project Restart began. And on top of that, you know, he had a bunch of shots. And I think what we've seen with Harry Kane is either a frustrated guy who isn't getting the ball where he wants it and is chasing around the pitch to try and be more involved in build-up play and isn't getting shots, or a Harry Kane who's hanging around the box, who's taking shots, but, like against Arsenal, is playing 9 passes a game, isn't super involved in the build-up, but just, you know, knows how to be where the goal is. And I think this was the kind of match that was a real synthesis of what we've seen from Kane so far, which was a guy who was involved in a lot of aspects of play and on the end of chances. I mean, I think, like you said, Greg, that third goal was remarkable, honestly. It was the 90th minute for a guy who we've seen not really be dynamic enough to make a lot of gut-busting runs, especially not after running for 90 minutes chasing the ball around. But he did that. He launched the counterattack from midfield with a really, really gorgeous through ball for Lamela to run onto, and then caught back up with it, and then finished the move off. Like, that's the Harry Kane we used to know, a guy who was involved in all phases of play, who was running tirelessly for 90 minutes, who was putting shots on goal, who was playing these like really creative passes that makes you wonder if maybe he should be a number 10 instead of a number 9. And he did it all at the very end of the game. And that, to me, was the most encouraging thing I think I could ask for from Harry Kane right now.
Well, and I think that's kind of what I miss out of Kane. And I think we've talked a lot about how we thought he couldn't do this anymore. But like, what I used to think about with Kane was constant movement. Like, he was always getting around the pitch to where, okay, he's going to play this pass here. He's played the pass, time to keep moving towards the goal. Oh, the Son's on the other side of the box. I'm going to position myself for a rebound. You know, that was sort of a hallmark of Kane, that he was always making these intelligent sort of movements around the pitch. And, you know, he made up for some of his other deficiencies in terms of pace, in terms of, you know, maybe his ability just to absolutely, you know, hit the ball, like, just kill a ball like Ronaldo could, you know, because he was always in the right position and made really smart decisions. And it's starting to seem like we may be getting some of those back. That, you know, that pass he made to Lamela, which was excellent, like, he's made a few of those passes in the last few games. And I don't know, it's like, you know, a lot of our problems go away if Harry Kane is even a semblance of his old self. And it's starting to look like that might not be as far-fetched as we thought. Now, we shouldn't get carried away, because he was looking like an absolute donkey like a week or two ago. But you got to at least be encouraged.
I think what's important to say is that, you know, we talked a lot about, well, Harry Kane needs service to thrive. And I think this game was the perfect counterfactual. Like, the things that Harry Kane did well were completely irrespective of the service he was provided. I mean, the moment we're talking about is Harry Kane creating an opportunity for someone else and then busting ass halfway down the field to clean that goal up. And, like, we've seen him not be there to sweep up garbage in the box very recently against Bournemouth, against Everton. And, you know, the story of this game, frankly, is the team was not very good, honestly. Like, Harry Kane was very good. And, you know, I think that very much flies in the face of the narrative that, like, Harry Kane will be good again when the team around him is creating opportunities for him. I mean, yes, that Bergwijn assist was very nice. But he still had a lot of work to do. And the third goal was all him. But outside of those opportunities, the game was not a dominant performance from Spurs. I mean, we got outshot like 22 shots by Newcastle, which is the most shots they've had all season. I'll qualify that by saying the defense did a pretty good job of limiting those chances from dangerous breaks and a lot of really threatening dribbling moves from Alan Saint-Maximin and DeAndre Yedlin to, you know, distance shots. But we were still giving up a ton of chances. We did not look comfortable really at any point in this game. I mean, you know, we scored the first goal and Newcastle hit back early in the second half. And there was not a sense that, like, well, it was only a matter of time before we put this game to bed. It was a nervy match where the team did not do their job in a lot of ways. But again, Harry Kane was the guy who really shone. So I think, A, the narrative that Harry Kane doesn't have service is bullshit, and B, this is a important benchmark in the continuing question of how good is Harry Kane and is Harry Kane back to his best.
So I kind of wanted to steer away from Harry Kane now, because I think the thing that I kind of took away from this game was just overall how kind of drab of a performance it was from Spurs. I don't want to say poor, because, you know, you look at some of the XG and the chances we got, and while, like Ben said, we didn't get a lot of chances, we did get some in very good positions. But, I mean, you know, this is a Newcastle team that's not very good, that plays a really kind of boring, low block, that doesn't play on the ball. And we let them have most of the possession. And, you know, like Ben said, we limited them to some, you know, long-range efforts. But it just didn't feel like...
It's not the kind of performance you feel good about.
Right. And, you know, like, look, I can, you know, some of it I can attribute to Jose Mourinho just doesn't play the type of, you know, free-flowing attacking football that, you know, we as Spurs fans have come to expect. And, you know, part of it is attributable to, you know, our midfield is still broken, and Harry Winks and Moussa Sissoko is not exactly a midfield that's going to control a game. But it's just, I don't know. I just thought, like, overall, while the result was very good, pleased to get a 3-1 victory, pleased for Harry Kane, I don't know. The performance was just okay. And, like, you know, ideally, you want to see a better performance than that against Newcastle. I understand it's at St. James's Park. You know, I understand that Jose Mourinho doesn't have a good record there, but there's no fans. There's no, like, atmosphere there that's going to prevent, you know, us from playing our game. I don't know.
Maybe a bit of an emotional hangover after the derby. Maybe, if you want to give some credit to extenuating circumstances. But, yeah, you're right. It was not a dynamic, comprehensive 3-1 win.
I thought this game was kind of a microcosm for Spurs' whole season. Maybe a little too positive for that. But, you know, it was this sort of incoherent Spurs team with a couple glaring holes and subpar performances that seems like adrift in terms of, like, a coherent management plan. Or, you know, it doesn't seem like there's a strategy there, which is maybe a little unfair because, like you said, Brian, we really did... If nothing else, Newcastle might have had a lot of chances, but they weren't exactly good chances. I mean, we weren't conceding quality XG. But at the same time, like, it's just this sort of blah, shiftless performance, but we have enough talented players that we kind of get away with it. And they sort of drag us over the line. And it's like, you know, it's sort of shiftless and as bad as we've looked all year. You know, we're still, you know, we could finish top six. I mean, you know, depending on how things break. And it's just... You know, but today, like, Harry Kane had a few good moments, Son had a few good moments, Bergwijn, you know, created some quality. It's just, you know, I would just like to see a more coherent plan. And like you said, it's Newcastle, it's away, it's Mourinho doesn't seem to play well at St. James, it's Mourinho in general, and maybe he'll have a more coherent strategy after he has a quote-unquote summer to sort of, you know, reset things and get a player or two in here. But it's just, I don't know, is this like, you would like to see this team have the kind of quality win that a 3-1 scoreline implies. And we just didn't get that. And I don't know, and I guess that's even more frustrating when you consider how sort of coherent we did look against Arsenal, where we did have a very specific game plan that we were able to execute. And you'd like to think that if we can execute against Arsenal, we can execute against fucking Newcastle, especially when we're scoring relatively early goals in the match.
Well, I mean, look, it's not that I don't think we executed, you know, because I think Jose probably had a very boring game plan for this match. But it's just like, at the same time, I don't know. I try not to be quite as anti-Jose as a lot of other people are, but at the same time, like, I want to beat teams that are worse than us, and I want to look good-ish doing it. Like, you know, like, I don't want to have to beat Newcastle 5-4 and score an 89th minute winner.
No, yeah, I don't want it to be nervy until the 90th minute. Like,
right. Like I said earlier, the 3-1 scoreline is great. Like, the Harry Kane performance is great. The goal from Heung-min Son, great. Like, we had some great chances. We scored some good goals. But it was all the kind of in-between stuff. It was like, it's the midfield that, you know, not really controlling play, not really doing anything incisive when it is on the ball. Like, you know, I think it's pretty telling that, you know, the Harry Kane, you know, scores and sets up that last goal, that, you know, the Bergwijn goal comes from, you know, him making a decent run down the flank. Like, you know, our midfield isn't setting up recycling possession, making cool through balls, or, you know, doing dynamic runs from deep. Like, the Sissoko winks, and even Lo Celso midfield isn't... It hasn't been that exciting the last few matches. It's been effective, but not exciting.
I mean, I'll disagree. I think the Arsenal game was very exciting. I thought we played a very well-drilled tactical performance that created a lot of chances.
But do you think that's attributable to, like, the Winks-Sissoko axis in midfield?
No. I mean, no. But I think they did, you know, their job effectively and allowed the players in front of them to do their job really well. And honestly, you know, I think it was Pep who once called us the Harry Kane team in a very disparaging manner. But I think this is a reminder that, you know, that's not the worst thing in the world. When you have a guy like Harry Kane, and if he can be on song as one of the best strikers in the world, this collection of talent is good enough to get you over the hump. And, you know, even in a drab performance where we didn't have a great tactical plan, where a lot of players looked very hungover from the Arsenal match, and we didn't seem like we had a lot of great ideas, having, you know, that transcendent talent up top. I mean, Son's goal was also phenomenally well taken.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the two goals from Kane were also both beautiful. I mean, the last one, you know, was a little sloppy, bounced off the goalkeeper's hands. But, you know, it doesn't take a lot to get this squad of players to turn shitty performances into wins. And if we can get our star players back into the kind of form that can do that, that can take a mediocre game like this and turn it into a comfortable 3-1 win in the end, you know, and then we can couple that with games like we had against Arsenal, like, that's a really good season we're talking about. You know, I don't know how I ended up being the Jose optimist here, but...
Well,
you know,
I mean,
like,
look, I think you're right in that...
You can see this.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I was just going to say, I think you're right in that, you know, we've always talked about, you know, are Spurs able to win ugly? You know, when we come up against, you know, Tony Pulis-managed clubs, are we able to grind out a 2-1 victory against a West Brom? Are we able to, you know... And so this match didn't feel like necessarily us grinding out a victory. It was, you know, the 3-1 scoreline felt mostly comfortable. You know, even when we were level, it felt like this was something we were going to get back into. So I understand that aspect of it. And, you know, I guess my thing is I think against a team that has shown so little desire to be on the ball as Newcastle has all season and has shown so little attacking impetus, and a team that is playing a midfield that is basically Nabil Bentaleb and Jonjo Shelvey, I would have liked us to control this match a little more. And again, like I said, the result is good. You know, winning games is great. Getting Harry Kane to score is great. But, like, this is a match that we should have just been on the front foot the whole time.
You can say the same thing about Bournemouth. I mean, we've had a few of these.
Right. And, you know, I started this all by saying that it didn't look like we had a tactical plan. But, you know, again, if I'm being incredibly generous to Jose, Newcastle is a team that it does not want the ball. They are very uncomfortable in possession. They want to sit low, and counter with like three guys at a time and hope something breaks right for them. You know, you can see why, okay, well, let's put the attacking impetus on Newcastle, make them have the ball and make them come out of that shell and try to hurt us because we know they can't, and then we can catch them on the break. And like, it's a shitty, boring way to play soccer, especially against a team that their defense is not good enough to play the way that they want to play. I mean, you see Man City go to Newcastle and put them under the cosh, and their defenders just aren't good enough, frankly, to play the low block that they want to play. And they got overwhelmed very, very easily, and they shipped like five goals. You know, that's the kind of game I would love to see Spurs play against a team like Newcastle, is let them play the game they want and trust that we're better than them, and we're going to break down whatever they want to do because they suck and we're good. That's not what we did, and it still worked. You know, it makes me sad that that's the kind of team we might be. Is the kind of team that says to a bad team, you know, here, take all the ball you want and try and do some damage, and when you can't, we'll capitalize on it. Like, that's not fun. I mean, this game was not fun. The Arsenal game was, you know, it was anxious. It was the North London Derby, but it was a fun game to watch. Especially if you weren't a Spurs fan, you would have watched that game and been like, that was a good 90 minutes of soccer. You watch this game and you were like, this was a fucking tedious, miserable slog. But it worked. And I don't know, I can kind of squint and see a dumb plan there that at least looks like a plan. And I may be giving Jose way too much credit, but, you know, for all Newcastle had the ball, and I think a lot of my feelings of nervousness during that game was just, had very little to do with Newcastle and a lot to do with Tottenham Hotspur. You know, I've just seen us fuck it up so many times. I've seen us surrender possession to a bad team like a Burnley, like a Bournemouth, like a whoever, and see them punish us. And they didn't. I mean, they really, like, they scored a goal on a dumb clearance with a great shot from a bad angle. But by and large, like, you know, Alan St. Maximin looks very exciting when he's dribbling the ball. But that's really all they did, was look exciting dribbling the ball towards us. And, you know, they took a bunch of shots from non-threatening areas. I don't know. It's, if that's how we play, it's going to be a terrible season to watch next season. But again, if our good players are good in that context, it's going to win games.
So let's talk about next season, because there was a lot that came out in the papers today that we're recording this on Thursday night in America, just for clarification, in case something changes between now and when you listen to us. Yeah, it, I mean, this could be a different structure next year. I think one thing that is in the papers, which, you know, I don't know if this is just trying to scare suitors away or what, but it seems like Levy is really putting the screws to Mourinho to figure out a way to make Ndombele work, which is encouraging. I really do think between Ndombele being a record signing and COVID just fucking up the transfer market, I don't think he's going anywhere this summer.
Yeah, I think the question that we all have is what the transfer window is even going to look like. You know, it looks like the Premier League's transfer window is going to go from sometime here at the end of July until October something. I think October 5th, maybe 10th, something. You know, it's... We don't know what teams are going to have money. I mean, because teams are losing out on gate receipts. We don't know. UEFA competitions haven't completely played out yet, so we don't know who has Champions League or places in some countries. Like, I don't know. It's going to be a weird window. But I think you're right. I think with respect to Ndombele, the type of return on the money that Levy would want. And I think we've said this before, you're really looking at only a handful of clubs. There's, you know, you're looking at the big super teams. And, you know, are PSG going to splash that much cash on Ndombele? Are Barcelona really interested in laundering that much money to get Ndombele? Like, you know, Real Madrid just won a title. Are they interested in him? Like, I don't think so. So, you know, I think if you're Levy, the practical thing is to just tell your manager to figure out how to make this work. And whether that's a fitness issue in terms of getting Ndombele fit, or if it is a tactical issue, or a Jose being a jackass issue, or whatever it is, like, you just have to tell him, like, he needs to play. He needs to play, you know, 30 matches next year, and that's just the way it is.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the big transfer that we're linked with is Pierre-Emile Højbjerg from Southampton. And it seems like we're going to send Kyle Walker-Peters their way as make-weight for Højbjerg. Couple that with the rumors about Ndombele and the state of the transfer market, it sounds like the goal for next season is to get a midfield of those guys and Lo Celso. And, you know, maybe we'll bring in Max Aarons at right back, or, you know, some other tweaks around the margins. But there's some center backs we're linked with as well. But by and large, I think we're going to be looking at this squad plus a defensive midfielder in terms of, like, our first choice lineup. And, you know, you look at what we've done the last couple matches, and you replace Winks and Sissoko with Højbjerg and Ndombele. And I think that's a good team. Like, I think that's a good team, even under Jose, even under whatever we're doing. You know, you allow those kinds of players to flourish, and they're going to do some damage to people. You know, I think there's very much a question about if Ndombele is going to go. But as Brian points out, there's a very small market of people who are capable of making that purchase. And particularly Daniel Levy, based on, you know, reading between the lines of all the news reports, doesn't seem interested in letting him go.
You don't even have to, I mean, this report,
for cheap.
This report that came out doesn't, I mean, you don't even have to read between the lines. It seems like they're flat out saying the plan next year is to, like, put Højbjerg in there and play Ndombele and Lo Celso in a more advanced role. And I mean, frankly, putting aside, like, if we were reading that about, like, Pochettino or a manager we felt more positive about, that's exactly the kind, I mean, even with Mourinho, that's exactly the kind of shit I want to see. Because I, like, Ndombele can do a job in that, but that's not what I want him doing. Like, I want him upfield causing havoc and causing problems. Like, you know, get someone else to take out the trash.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess I think, you know, if we're going to talk transfers and stuff like that, the thing that I keep seeing online is, especially from Spurs fan, is like 10 tweet long threads where they talk about we need these six signings and that'll make this team, you know, the top four or title contender. And I think we all have to be prepared for, like, this is going to be a pretty quiet window, not just from Spurs, but I think from everybody.
I agree.
I mean, I think, you know, I talked a little bit a second ago about, like, you know, the uncertainty in terms of, like, what money is available and stuff. But, like, I think what you're going to end up seeing is a lot of loans, you know, of the players that would be big signings. Excuse me. You're going to see loans of the players that would be big signings. And they'll wind up with, you know, future optional purchase clauses or mandatory purchase clauses, you know, at the end of next season or whatever. And so I don't know that you'll see, like, big time transfer moves. And, you know, a player like Højbjerg, who is available for a fairly reasonable price, is probably the type of players that you're going to see moving this window. You're not going to see Ndombele or Lo Celso level sort of guys making big switches this summer, I don't think.
I think you might see a couple, like, high profile loans that might sort of preview, like, a bigger transfer maybe next window. But, yeah, I think you're right. I think it's going to be a fairly mild window. And, you know, the thing about this team is, like, putting our concerns with Mourinho aside, like, I think we're a ways away from being a title challenger, but I don't think we're that far away from being a very good team. I mean, you put Højbjerg in that midfield, you get Ndombele and Lo Celso playing together. You know, I mean, there's, you know, if you could somehow just make our fullback situation, and I know that's easier said than done, but you know, you get a slightly more stable or reliable fullback situation in there. And I, you know, that's a pretty good Tottenham team, especially if you assume Kane is capable of, you know, playing at 70-80% of what we used to get out of him. I mean, I don't think we're that far away from being decent. It's just the issue of, A, there's Mourinho and how much you trust him with any roster at this point. And B, you know, what are we going to get out of Kane and what are we going to get out of our fullbacks?
Right. I mean, so much of this depends on whose name is Harry Kane. You know, if Harry Kane is good, then it can compensate for a team that looked like we did against Newcastle. And if we can make a better team behind that Harry Kane, then, yeah, now we're talking. If Harry is not good, then we might be in trouble.
Well, that's what...
You know, I'm excited about the links to Arkadiusz Milik, who
yeah.
I may be saying very wrong. But he's a guy who's similarly aged and similarly injury-prone, but also similarly a
younger, actually. He's like a year younger, I think.
He's 26. I don't know how old Harry Kane is anymore.
I think he's 27 this month.
30, I wouldn't know.
Point is, he is way younger, not Harry. Milik is way younger than I would have guessed.
Yeah, I think in my brain, like, we were linked with him when he was a teenager, and he had a trial here and didn't end up coming. And so he's just been a person in my brain for so long, I think, that it's like, wait, how old are you? And, you know, he just hasn't done enough at Napoli that you're like, he just hasn't been a guy you've been paying
yeah,
attention
but
to.
Yeah, but you can see
but
what...
when he's fit, he scores.
Yeah,
he's good.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing that makes me encouraged about bringing him to Spurs is, like, I would imagine any world in which he comes to Tottenham Hotspur, his minutes are going to be managed. And in theory, that would mean we can play him more and he will be good when he's on the pitch. Or, like, you know, play him more than our backups, not play him more than he's played at Napoli. Play him more than the other backups we've had. And frankly, fuck it, I'm fine trying this. We've tried doing young players. We've tried doing, you know, like, young, up-and-coming.
We've tried Llorente. We've tried old guys.
Yeah, we've tried everything. Let's go get a guy who's pretty decent, but his injuries probably keep him from being a full-time starter somewhere. He'll make, like, Premier League money, and, like, I don't know, maybe we can sell him a fucking, like, Swansea or West Brom or some shit in like 2 years if he plays well for us. It's just he's good enough at Napoli, and especially you think if we can manage his minutes a little bit better than they've been able to, he can probably stay on the pitch for what we need out of him. And if that's an enticing proposition.
Yeah, I mean, if we can platoon him and Kane together in a way that allows Kane some days off that he doesn't feel sad about and allows him to allows Milik to look like a good Premier League player. You know, that's a really good situation to have, you know, for your striker. I don't know if we're going to land him, but
it's just one of those things. It's funny because, you know, we kind of came, you know, if we all kind of, those of us on the podcast, think back to the beginning of kind of our Spurs fandom. which is you know,
the yearly tradition.
Yeah, arguably more recent than some of the other people that might be listening to the podcast. But we're talking about, you know, the you know, the early aughts, or excuse me, you know, mid aughts to early 20-teens. You know, Spurs were looking for like the guy as their striker, their 30 goal a season striker. You know, you had Keane and Berbatov, and they were a great partnership, and they scored a lot of goals. And then, you know, when Berbatov left, you were kind of like searching for like the guy, and Kane became the guy. But then what we lost was Spurs also seemed to always have, you know, the guys that you could plug in. You had Adebayors, you had Pavlyuchenkos, Jermaine Defoe's, like, you know, guys that you could just throw, that you knew that they weren't your guy. But if you threw Jermaine Defoe on, you know, for the last 30 minutes of a match, he would probably get a couple chances. He might score a goal. If your main striker got injured and you had to rely on Jermaine Defoe for, you know, 5-6 games in a row, he was good enough to do that. And so we don't necessarily have that anymore. I understand that we have Heung-min Son as our backup, but he's like useful in other positions. He starts other times. Like, he's not like a lead the line guy. if we had somebody that we could use in an alternative to Harry Kane, it would be great. Like, we used to have that. We used to have just a collection of guys that we could rotate. And then we finally got, like, a world-class guy that we developed. And then we just gave up on having other rotational options around him. And now we're just stuck with no rotational options. And when we're scraping, you know, it feels like we're scraping the bottom of the barrel to find guys. Like, we're having to take... Not that Milik is a flyer.
I was about to say, Milik's honestly a couple steps above what I thought we would be looking
for.
No,
certainly Milik is not like an example. Like, you know, Llorente is an example of, you know, what we're talking about here. But, like, and Milik would be, you know, Milik would not be a cheap player. Let's make sure that's clear. He's not going to be someone that costs, you know, 15 or even 20 million pounds. Like, he is going to be 25 to 30 million pounds. Like, his goal scoring record, despite the injuries, is still pretty good. So, you know, I don't know. I'm interested in a player like that, though, as opposed to, you know, the kid that's at Salzburg or the guy at Lille, Osimhen.
Osimhen.
Is that it?
Yeah. His name looks like it should be pronounced Osimhen, which would be really cool. That's a cool name. It's like Osimhen, where the chickens anyway, like an awesome chicken. I'm on board with that. But no, it's like an Irish guy who jizzed a lot. His name is Victor Osimhen.
Oh, my God.
All right,
and
well.
You say that.
I don't know. I the links to that feel so ridiculous to me. Like, it's clear that, like, Napoli is going to buy him with their ill-gotten gains, and, you know, we're just not going to get him.
Sorry to cut you off, Ben. That's a trade that I'm fine with. Napoli takes him from Lille, and then we take Milik from Napoli. Like, whatever. That's fine. I'm okay with that.
And Milik hasn't linked with Juve, so it's not nailed on. But there's been enough rumors that makes me excited. Because it's like, you know, to put it in, like, Premier League terms, it would be nice to get to go play, like, Bournemouth and rest Harry Kane for a more important match and say, okay, we're going to play a guy about as good as Callum Wilson, and you're going to play Callum Wilson, but we're going to have a better team, and we're going to trust that that's going to work out for us. And right now our option is like, well, we're going to play Harry Kane again and hope that playing Harry Kane 50 times a season isn't going to lead to diminishing returns. And like, yeah, that's an insane way to play.
Or conversely,
has the ability to rotate and rest and whatever. We just don't have that.
Or conversely, it would be nice to, like, have Harry Kane available for Bournemouth because we sent Milik to Uzbekistan or wherever our, like, Europa League game that Wednesday is going to be, and we don't have to waste his legs on that game. So it's, yeah, it would give us options to manage Kane in a way that we really have left ourselves unable to do over the last few years. And I don't know, he's a talented enough player. It feels like kind of bargain Dzeko to me, you know. Let's get him. That would be nice. But let's get Holberg first.
What's his name again?
The DM from Southampton. Whose name I pronounced correctly earlier and now somehow unable to do it because we have to stay on brand on this podcast. Holsberg.
Hoiberg. Bjerg.
Oh, God.
It's not like the American basketball coach. It's like Hoy Bia. Yeah, it's the Bia. Right,
I just need to listen to an announcer say his name for like 3 weeks in a row, and then I'll get it.
I mean, it's not a guarantee it'll improve.
Good point. I think
anyway, the point is we're not far from being an okay team, even under Jose's spotty management.
Well, and I
if
think
our good players can be good and be put in a position to be good.
I mean, I don't know about you guys, my first thought when I heard we were My first thought when I heard we were hiring Mourinho is what the fuck. But my second thought, what I was always sort of worried about the danger of him is how he would manage our transfer policy. Specifically, like, and I think I've said this on this podcast before, Mourinho hasn't had to like really pinch pennies since he was maybe at Inter, if you're being generous. Certainly, like since Porto. And I guess, like, I was always worried that, you know, okay, yeah, he would eject a player like Ndombele, but also that he would just want us to go buy someone that didn't make sense and we couldn't afford. And, it would fuck up our whole window, or he'd start feuding with Levy, or whatever. I think this COVID thing this summer is going to save us, because I think Mourinho knows that we have to be a little bit thrifty. And it seems like, in terms of what we've been reading between the lines in the press, that Levy still has firm control on the transfer market. So, I don't know. It seems like we're at least going to avoid any Mourinho transfer problems this summer. Who fucking knows about after that? But it seems like in the short term, we're going to sort of skate on his worst tendencies.
So, let's get back to this season real quick. We've got two more games, and we are in touching distance of Europa League. Do you think we're going to get there?
I mean, we play Leicester, and we play, is it Palace?
Who's Crystal Palace.
Palace, yeah. I mean, those are winnable games. On the other hand, Dr. Tottenham would like to see you now. So. I mean, Brian, how do you feel about the teams that we're sort of running against for the rest of the season? Do you think they're going to drop the points we need them to drop?
I mean, look, we're in the position where we are right this second that if we win out, we're in. So, I mean, I'm not really worried about, well, I guess we're in the Europa League contingent upon, you know, Arsenal not making it to the FA Cup final. But, you know, that aside, yeah, I feel pretty good about it. I mean, you know, our last two matches are Crystal Palace and Leicester. They haven't been playing particularly well. You know, I know Leicester won against Sheffield United recently, but they got a lot of injuries. Like I we were talking about this before the show. Ben highlighted, you know, just how many players they have out right now, and they're playing Wes Morgan in defense. So I feel fairly good about that game. Crystal Palace are not that good. But then again, we also just drew with Bournemouth. So I don't know. But in terms of the teams around us, we're talking about Wolves, basically. Is like, can we jump over Wolves? And Wolves close out the season. They've got Palace next, and then they end the season with Chelsea. So if you think that we win both games and then Wolves maybe drop points to Chelsea, then maybe we can jump over them. So I feel pretty good.
I mean, we kind of control our destiny, assuming Arsenal play Man City in the next round of the FA Cup. Assuming Man City does their job and beats them, that means 7th place is a Europa League place, and we are currently in 7th and control our destiny. If we beat Leicester and we beat Palace, we're in. Like Brian alluded to, Leicester have been very injury hit. They are without James Maddison, Ricardo Pereira, Ben Chilwell, Soyuncu, who's been suspended for the rest of the season. You know, they are not the best version of them personnel-wise, and they haven't been the best version of themselves on the pitch basically since Project Restart. Just to get that in there one more time. You know, we are 1 point behind Wolves, 1 point ahead of Sheffield, and 1 point ahead of Arsenal. You know, we play, and it was Leicester and Palace. Sheffield play Everton and Southampton, and Arsenal probably have the easiest schedule left. They play Aston Villa and Watford. But although Arsenal's schedule looks easiest on paper, both of those teams are in a relegation fight and are going to be desperately calling for points in a way that Crystal Palace is not. Leicester today, honestly winning, puts them in a much better position than they had been in a while. You know, they're still not a lock for top four, but this helps. So they can still get there even if they lose to us. I don't see any reason. I mean, Leicester plays Man U on the final day of the season, and that's going to be, I think, the top four decider for them. So I think we've got it. I think we can get Europa League. I mean, I know a lot of Spurs fans maybe don't want Europa League and see it as a needless distraction,
Like, okay, I understand that we've had a lot of fun in the Champions League over the last few years, but, like, it is a little perplexing to me. Like, I mean, you look at Spain, they, you know, those teams seem to enjoy being in the Europa League and sort of make the most of it, and English teams just, I don't know, they treat it like a miserable slog, and admittedly, like, there's one round too many in that competition, and it's not as glamorous as the Champions League, but, you know, we do have a coach who is an expert in knockout competitions. Like, as much as I'd rather be in the Champions League, winning a European trophy would be a lot of fun. I mean,
well, I mean, the other thing is that the Europa League is two other things for us. It is one, it is additional money. I mean, you know, look, it's not the same amount of money that the Champions League is, but just being involved in those fixtures means more revenue into the club from the UEFA television pool. And the other thing is that being involved in those matches means coefficient points. And I know that that's like, you know, nerdy, dumb soccer stuff that, like, you know, normal people probably don't care about. But, like, that's the reason why we get put into pot three when we qualify for the Champions League, is because, like, our coefficient is trash. And so, like, if we go to the Europa League and perform like Wolves did this year, where we win all of our group games and, you know, we advance through the knockout rounds, like, those are coefficient points. And then so when we re-qualify for the Champions League next year because we won the Premier League in 2020-21, you know, then we can be in pot one because we won the Champions League. But won
hey,
the Premier
dummy,
League.
If you win the Premier League, you're
yeah,
in
yeah,
pot
we get
one
in pot one automatically. I know. Coefficient doesn't matter. So, you know, when we don't win the Premier League on the last day because of some unfortunate result involving lasagna or whatever, you know, we get in pot two or whatever. And so like, these things are important. And like you said, Greg, like, I don't know, knockout competitions are fun. Like, I get it. You don't want to go to Estonia. Like, that's, I get it. But, like, you know, look at some of the Europa League, you know, last 16 matches that are you know, that are going to happen coming up in August. You know, some of those clubs are really good, big clubs. Like, I know we treat it like a Mickey Mouse competition because, like, that's the attitude that English fans have towards it. But, like, do you don't want to win it at all?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I get, like, look, I get that it feels less than the Champions League, and especially after the last few years, it's especially going to feel less than, but it's a knockout competition, it could be fun. You know, the Europa League should look a lot different than it is. I don't understand why it's not straight knockouts. It would be a lot more fun that way, but it is what it is, and, you know, I'd rather be in Europe than not be in Europe, and I think you could look at, you know, the difference between a club like Spurs, which easily gets its ass out of whatever Europa League group we've ever played in, versus a team like Everton that, like, doesn't know how to cope with Europe on any level. And there is an advantage to this, as much as we would all rather be in the Champions League and how difficult that might be in the years ahead. I don't know. I'd rather be in it than not, though.
I mean, you know, I think you look back at our history in the Europa League recently, and that was the platform that Harry Kane was given to become the Harry Kane that we all know and love. You know, I think a lot of us saw what he did under Tim Sherwood briefly at the end of his reign and thought, okay, he deserves a chance in the Premier League. But Pochettino did not give him that chance until he just absolutely lit the Europa League on fire. And there is a real opportunity there to blood some youngsters, some fringe players, and find out about your squad in a way that harder, more competitive competitions like the Champions League don't allow. And its absence doesn't even give you those games where you can experiment a little bit and see what you have. So from like a squad standpoint, I think there's a really exciting opportunity to kind of find guys. B, it's just nice. I mean, I know it's been miserable watching Spurs a lot this season, but generally speaking, it is nice to have an extra game a week to be like, oh, I get to watch my favorite soccer team. This is nice.
Be careful what you wish for, Ben.
I know. You know, I mean, we're going to have to put the Oh, What a Night song kind of on the back burner for a year.
Yeah, it's a shame because my son actually really likes that song. So,
well,
think so.
He's in for a world of pain.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I think we, you know, lately we've looked at teams like Leicester and Liverpool who have had very good seasons on the back of not being involved in European qualification or European competition. Leicester won the title and Liverpool got back to the Champions
Chelsea,
League.
Chelsea had a similar season.
Chelsea also. You know, have all benefited from this. And I think there's definitely a temptation to say, well, the league's all that matters and qualifying the Champions League is all that matters and the Europa League is a distraction. I just refuse to accept that it has to be that way, honestly. And I will be excited to see us in Europe again, even if we're playing, you know, FC Concrete Company from whoever Eastern European nonsense.
I think the anti Europa League attitude is something you talk yourself into if you're in 12th and you're like, oh well, we obviously didn't even want the Europa League, so you know, next year, you know, because I think that's what that happened with that Chelsea team that one year, didn't they finish like 10th?
Yeah.
You know, and then go on to win the title the next season. Like, I think if you're in the position where, you know, you don't have to do anything extraordinary or you don't need miraculous results to get into the Europa League, you want to be in it. Like, you want the money, you want the coefficient, you want the matches, you want the prestige. You want to be there. The club wants to be there. As a fan, you want those matches.
I mean, there's a level at which...
Let me be clear. The Europa League is not going to be the difference between Spurs and the title next season.
No.
Like, I think what we all should probably accept that.
I mean, what I think, I do think, there is a burn it all down part of me that thinks it would be incredibly funny if Mourinho won the Europa League with Tottenham Hotspur next year. Because he's demonstrated before he's good at knockout competitions, and the level of talent is such, like, I mean, there's no reason Tottenham Hotspur can't win the Europa League.
And so now it's a route back into the Champions League. You win the Europa League, you get in the Champions League, so you don't have to finish top four. Just ask Jose.
That's what he did at United.
Right.
Oh man, just already looking for silver linings to our clouds. Well, on that note, I think it's time to wrap it up for today. Ben, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me rambling nonsense on Twitter at Comrade Uspurs.
And Brian, where can people find you on the tubes?
Well. Brian, you're muted. So no one's going to listen to you on Twitter because you can't figure out how to use technology.
I had such a good joke, and now it's gone.
But see, now I don't have to edit this out, so it all worked out.
No, I mean, it's fine. I'm on Twitter, Brian.
Do you really get joke? Tell us your good joke, Brian.
No, it's fine.
I want to hear the joke.
It's not funny anymore.
Brian.
It's a funny podcast, look, so let's hear a good joke.
I know you don't understand this, Ben. Most of comedy is timing. What was I saying? Brian_Ashlock, Brian with a Y on Twitter. I tweet about stuff. Not really, but I will like things if you post them and they are good.
You can follow me on Twitter.com at SkipJack0079. And for Brian, for Ben, and of course for Brett Rainbow, I've been your host, Greg. Come on, you Spurs.